The title of my talk today is Before Foucault, Power and Cynical Ideology. Let me just begin with Before Foucault. A premonitory theorist of history is yet to surface, silenced prematurely by death, but still speaking to us insistently, urgently, passionately through the continued life of his writings. We are, I believe, still living before Foucault. Before Foucault, that is, in Nietzsche's sense, that Foucault's time has not yet come. That his thought anticipates in its most dystopian moment the migration of power into institutions and mechanisms of control and into bodies with such intensity that we can literally speak now of a future of the possessed individual as the singular effect of power, our future. And also speak in its most utopian moment of a form of citizenship yet to be realized that will potentially be crafted from Foucault's prudential ethics articulated so eloquently and so well in The Care of the Self. That which Foucault predicted, that which he patiently deconstructed in the gray language of genealogical research, the archaeology of prison, the birth of knowledge, the order of the clinic, the geographical traces of power, the genetic reduction of the body, have, I believe, not yet been fully realized before Foucault. This time, our historical time, is yet a time of emergence, suspended between power speaking in the name of death and power speaking in the name of life. In a period, for example, in which the much trumpeted so-called revolution in military affairs signals or aligns itself with a hand-to-mouth existence of a reactive fascism practiced in the name of American empire, who can deny the truth-saying of Foucault's prophetic insights about our reality today as a theater of cynical power, of cynical truth? So then, I'd like to begin this talk with Foucault, with what he has to say about the insurrection of subjugated knowledge and with his five methodological precautions. It's entirely fitting, I believe, that Foucault first articulated his theories of power in his famous lecture, Society Must Be Defended, the Collège de France in the Paris winter of 1975-1976. Himself, really, the first practitioner of the insurrection of subjugated knowledge, Foucault rebelled against all reductions of power to the system of right, to liberal theories of sovereignty, to juridical mechanisms, just as much as he refused to subordinate power to a reflex of ideology. Goodbye, Marxism. About this, Foucault was adamant. I quote, As I see it, we have to bypass or get around the problem of sovereignty, which is central to the theory of right and the obedience of individuals to submit to it, and to reveal the real problem of domination and subjugation instead of sovereignty and obedience. Now, because I wish to argue today that history has now moved, in fact, to a new plane, beyond power as Foucault conceived it, to a new plane that I would call an era of cynical ideology and of cynical power and of cynical truth, beyond normalization and, in effect, beyond Foucault, I'd like to begin, really, with a patient deconstruction of Foucault's genealogy of power, his five methodological presuppositions about power. They've become cliches, really, and they're eloquent. First, for Foucault, this is the Collège de France. First, a regional, interventionary approach to understanding power. I quote Foucault, "Our object is not to analyze rule-given and legitimate forms of power which have a single center, or to look at what their general mechanisms or its overall effects might be. Our object, on the contrary, is to understand power by looking at its extremities, its outer limits, at the point where it becomes capillary, in other words, to understand power in its most regional forms and institutions, and especially at those points where this power transgresses the rules of right that organize and delineate it, oversteps those rules and in its vested institutions, is embodied in technique and acquires the material means to intervene, sometimes in violent ways. Second, power is a relation of force. The question is this, Foucault. What happens at the moment of and at the level of the procedure of subjugation, or in the continuous and uninterrupted processes that subjugate bodies and direct gestures and regulate forms of behavior? In other words, rather than asking ourselves what the sovereign looks like from on high, we should be trying to discover how multiple bodies and forces and energies and matters and desires and thoughts are gradually, progressively, actually and materially constituted as subjects, or as the subject. Third, power produces subjectivity and enables agency. Foucault again. Don't regard power as a phenomenon of mass and homogeneous domination, the domination of one individual over others, of one group over others, of one class over others. Power functions. power is exercised through networks, and individuals don't simply circulate in those networks. They're in a position both to submit to and to exercise this power. Fearless speech, a space for a critical ethos. Power, truth speaks with and against power. In other words, power passes through individuals that does not apply to them. Fourth, a gray genealogy of power. Power isn't distributed through the body in democratic or anarchic fashion. We should really make an ascending analysis of power, or in other words, begin with its infinitesimal mechanisms, which have their own sedimented history, their trajectories, their own techniques and tactics, and then look at how these mechanisms of power, which have their own solidity, and in a sense their own technology, have been and are invested, colonized, used, inflected, transformed, displaced, extended by increasingly general mechanisms and forms of overall domination. And finally, and decisively, for Foucault, power aligns itself with knowledge, not with ideology. Foucault again. It's quite possible that ideological production did coexist with the great machineries of power. There is really no doubt about an ideology of education, an ideology of monarchical power, an ideology of parliamentary democracy, and so on. But I don't think that these ideologies are shaped at the base of the point where networks of power accumulate. It's much less and much more than that. It's the actual instruments that form and accumulate knowledge, the observational methods, the recording techniques, the investigative research procedures, the verification mechanisms. That is, the delicate mechanisms of power can function unless knowledge, or rather knowledge apparatuses, are formed and organized and put into circulation. And those apparatuses are not ideological trimmings or edifices. Power knowledge. Now, like power itself, everything in Foucault's thought flows from these five methodological precautions and presuppositions. Backwards, the birth of the clinic, the history of madness, the genealogy of the medical clinic, and forwards, the three successive histories of sexuality are absolutely haunted by the question of power that Foucault himself can't respond to. Here, I believe, speaking after Foucault, we are finally in the presence of what I would think of, and I've always thought of Foucault, as Max Weber Redux. This decisive theoretical moment when Weber's sociology of power, with its mysterious and seductive interplay of charisma and the routinization of power, achieves a final sublimation in a genealogical account of normativity, which, if it's impatient with the seduction of charisma, insists that the final bitter lesson to be learned from the routinization of power is its really sad but predictable reproduction of its effects. First, in that power effect, which we have come to know after Foucault as the sovereign individual of all respectable liberal theory, and then of the question of agency. For Foucault, really, agency is the dead resurrection effect of Weber's concept of charisma. It's that ideological effect of power which plays seductively the double role of both reproducing the limits of power while simultaneously challenging power as its limit experience. Fearless speech, the care of the self. In retrospect, in the representative figure of Foucault, it's as if European thought is summed up for one brilliant moment close to the end of the mass violence of the 20th century, speaking from a tiny Paris seminar room with all too vivid memories of German, Russian, and Chinese ideological totalizations to the east and the seduction of Hobbes and Leviathan to the Atlantic West, rebelling against both the ideological orthodoxies of actually existing Marxism on the one hand and liberally deprived systems of right on the other, insists on a final Weberian closure of political history. Having freed power from the tyranny of the philosophy of right and the carceral of sovereignty, Foucault then performs his own reductionist displacement, namely a sociological reduction of power to the language of normativity. Now, you know, at a strictly theoretical level, Foucault's transcription of power in the language of the norm could never be stabilized for long. And how could it be? The actual history of power has always outstripped any particular political history of power, including Foucault's. Let me explain. And this within our own regime, the capitalist regime. where the theory of power has always had a complex fourfold history. First, power as reification, expressed most brilliantly by George Lukács's The Reification of the Consciousness of the Proletariat. Second, Foucault's theorization of power in this language of normalization, but which soon, as almost in the act of writing it, was soon to be displaced by a really insurrectionary post-structuralist theory of power as not about reification and not power above normalization, but power as a play of signification. This move from power as normativity to the power of the sign was, for example, the basis of Jean Baudrillard's Oublié Foucault, and probably explains why Baudrillard was one of the few French theorists not invited to the funeral orations for Foucault himself. And of course, this has now been theoretically upstaged by a post-Baudrillardian maneuver, the theorization today of power in the language of virtuality. Sometimes, you know, technologically, in the terms of power as speed, think of Paul Virilio's vision of dromocratic power, taking virtual parasitical possession of our bodies, subjectivity, and desires, and sometimes also virtual in the sense of power as fantasy. Think of Zizek's Lacanian psychoanalytics of power. Consequently, four orders of power. Power as reification, power as normalization, as signification, and as virtuality. Each responding to a definite phase of modernism, postmodernism, now primitive posthumanism, all operating under the sign of capitalism, each representing a line of flight in Deleuze and Guattari's sense, as power seeks its moment of maximum intensity in different historical circumstances, each succeeding the other, definitely not canceling the other, but displacing them, forcing its effects to be retranscribed, displaced to other regimes of truth, each allying itself in turn with an emergent class interest. For example, power's reification. That's the original nomenclature of early bourgeois class fragments, intent on the retranscription of all experience under the universal and abstracted sign of the commodity form. Power's normalization. Weber's specialists of the knowledge apparatus, psychiatry and medicine and penology and confessionality. Power's signification. Here the commodity form circulates as a fluid sign system, becoming itself a seductive and violent sign of advanced capitalism. And power is virtuality. With this, we witness the emergence of what I would call the virtual class, the first authentically original class expression of globalization, which, beginning as an ideology of facilitation of the so-called digital revolution, quickly assumes its contemporary form as an ideology of coercive network consolidation as a basis of networked capitalism. Ironically, and this in retrospect, we might say that the history of power itself has rewritten Foucault, that the genealogy of power has itself become an insurrection of subjugated knowledge, that power not only produces today individuals as its effects, not only enables agency, but perhaps envious of its displacement in specifically human form, has assumed an almost erotic form of individuality, that power today has literally come alive, has auto-enabled itself in the language of agency with all the mechanisms of control and fear. Remember Deleuze and Guattari. Power becomes an intensity, a line of flight. It becomes the seductive voice of the little fascist within, as well as the agent of fearless speech. It becomes the white noise of the media, but it also becomes the recalcitrant singularity of human subjectivity. It's all the actual materiality of cynical power. Now, I take Foucault seriously at his word that theory is a toolbox, that the measure of the power of a theory is its ability not only to interpret the world, but if it would be critical, to actually catalyze an insurrection of subjugated knowledge. Foucault not only wrote this, but he practiced it, both as a prisoner's rights activist and in the praxis of the history of sexuality, which is itself a struggle against the forces of sexual repression and confused liberation. Consequently, following Foucault's own political practice, I would like to argue today that political theory can no longer really be Foucauldian in its reflexive coupling of power knowledge, But we must return now to the radically changed field of politics. Over and beyond Foucault's five methodological precautions about power, I would like to argue that the logic of history has itself mutated, that we are living today not so much under the sign of power, but under the sign of cynical ideology. And I'd like to begin this discussion with a very specific example. It's what I call the age of our age as the age of the imperial subaltern. For example, consider how power today, how power actually functions in the global politics of empire. The power of empire speaks now in the language of what I would call the imperial subaltern. Power speaks in the language of the insurrection of subjugated knowledge. Power no longer really wants to be identified only as a relation of force, but it really wants to be identified as something ambivalent, something containing a form of otherness. Power speaks with a voice of not force, singularly. It also speaks with a voice of an aggrieved victim, demanding, even crusading for, righteous justice. That's the politics of the so-called war on terrorism. In its historical self-consciousness, imperial power becomes today an insurrection of subjugated knowledge. Power today actually has advantage to reverse fields. It effectively repolarizes the field of power itself. With this, contemporary politics witnesses the radical transformation of all existing theories of power in the post-colonial world, specifically a real disturbance in the privileged dialectic of hegemonic power on one side and subaltern subjectivity on the other, the dialectics of modernism, the subjectivity of this, that is, of those dominated by imperial power. Now, power, probably wise to the game of moral communities of grievance, based on subaltern grievances against perceived hegemonic power blocks, perhaps already attracted by the eloquence and the seduction and the criticality of fearless speech, of power which would speak to truth. This they drive to American empire in its expression. This form of power has quickly reversed the terms of the dialectic of post-colonial domination and has immediately and imminently adopted for itself a new political identity today, not as imperialism, but as the imperial subaltern. Here, imperialism, refusing to recognize its previous boundaries as a model of exclusively economic domination, reaches out instead to become a psycho-ontology of life itself, fueled by a powerful, aggrieved sense of moral grievance, animated by a pervasive sense of psychological insecurity, constantly driven by fear of deadly attacks from outside and inside, not even trusting itself, unified by spectacles of explosive violence directed against nominated scapegoats. The imperial subaltern, American empire, blends together panic, fear, and sacrificial violence into a liquid language of new imperial power. Externally triumphalist, because of its self-consciousness as the historical embodiment of the Kantian vision of the universal good, and internally panicked because of the specter of an always threatening outside world, the imperial subaltern, this ambivalent way in which power works today, projects itself onto political history as that strangest of all power idioms that we've ever witnessed, part victim, part savior. Violated, vulnerable, aggrieved, aggressive, the imperial subaltern can reserve the art to spasms, preemptive violence with good conscience, because a double language of victim-missionary is the necessary logic of moral expiation through sacrificial violence. With this, all previous formulations of imperialism in terms of a specifically economic translation are, I believe, forced to give way to the new reality of this new type of fascist imperialism. Imperial because its will continues to be a hegemonic capitalist order based on a strictly unequal economic distribution. And fascist because its power is liquid, virulent, constantly leading a hand-to-mouth existence, always provoking turbulence. The imperial subaltern specializes in the cultural translation of full-spectrum military domination now into full-spectrum metabolic domination later. in perfect fulfillment of Foucault's image of power over life, the imperial subaltern, culturally fascist and economically hegemonic, has no ultimate purpose other than the double project of colonizing the totality of life space, liquidating in turn what it considers to be non-life, non-being, meaning your scapegoat. Now, I stress this example of how power actually operates in the age of the imperial subaltern because it illuminates for myself a broader movement beyond Foucault's theory of power to cynical ideology today as the basis of politics. Humiliation, revenge-seeking, sacrificial expenditure, these are the new coinage of the 21st century politics of state terrorism and sometimes national, then religious, or tribal insurgencies. Really, it's a game of deadly challenge and violent response is inaugurated between the imperial subaltern and the many expressions today of what I would call subaltern imperialisms. Again, the power of the imperial subaltern is based on a double moral economy, panicking insecurity and redemptive violence, a moral economy which is most brilliantly theorized not so much by Foucault with his insistence on studying the traces of power and knowledge and its oppositions, but by another French theorist, Georges Bataille, with his searing theory of the scapegoat and his concept of the reduction of politics to the logic of sacrificial expenditure. With this insight, politics is reconfigured as operating under the sign of cynical ideology, a political regime which, abandoning the sociological mechanisms of control imminent to power knowledge, practices cynicism with such ideological excess that politics now literally experiences a morphological change of state, one which has compulsive public lying as its ontology, abuse value as its ethics, redemptive values as its practice, and the terrorism of the image as its epistemology. Compulsive deceit, compulsive lying. Where to begin? In terms of American empire as the imperial subaltern, perhaps with those subjugated knowledge, those genuine expressions of fearless speech, of, for example, American Scholars for Truth about 9/11, who has a group of carefully documented a very different story than the official version about the events on that epical day, and one which implicates the national security state in the events of 9/11 and its aftermath. Or begin with the potentially insurrectionary knowledge of small groups of fearless private American citizens and individual scholars, who, derided and marginalized by both major political parties, have gathered and continue to gather evidence of two stolen elections. The first by vote fraud and voter intimidation, the second by counting fraud. For example, west of the Mississippi, there was not one touchscreen voting machine in any state or any precinct, Democrat or Republican, which gave a positive return for John Kerry. After this, I believe that public lying reaches such a point of excess that it simply passes out of consciousness. It becomes a cliche. Becomes something taken for granted as the actually existing framework of political life. Society numbs itself to public deceit or adopts a quintessentially neoconservative version of postmodern referentials, whereas truth is perceived to be nominalistic, purely of strategic value in the pursuit of the greater truth of the war on terrorism. So-called weapons of mass destruction, denials of torture, Guantanamo Bay, the cruel theater, for example, of humiliated subjectivity with its private lies and personal self-effacement down at that Texas ranch for Cheney's shotgun victim. And this is beyond the event itself, is actually compelled to publicly apologize on television for having caused distress to the vice president and to his family. It's really the American equivalent of the confession necessary to all show trials. I think online open democracy, a net site, which Jim sent me, analyzed it best. And I quote, I think it's really an epical quote. The curiosity surrounding the vice president's accident that created a contemporary version of Rules of the Game with a Texas twist. Jean Renoir's 1939 film, politicians and aristocrats mingle at a country house in France over a long weekend, during which a merciless hunt ends with a tragic shooting. Appearing on the eve of the Second World War, the Rules of the Game depicted a hypercritical, ruthless, and decadent ruling class that makes its own rules and leads society to the edge of catastrophe. So I would ask, thinking about how power actually functions, the imperial subaltern, Could public lying today on a massive scale be the rhetorical reflex of the age of the imperial subaltern? Has the mixture of panic, fear, and redemptive violence pushed Foucault's concept of power and knowledge aside in favor of something more primary, more ideologically cynical? Here, the exercise of power against comfort politicians, populations, is itself, I believe, a secondary effect of a more primary movement of political force driven by cynical ideology. By the move to reorder the world through an ideology of redemptive violence and panic fear, which really has no necessary truth, nor does it have a definitive end. For the imperial subaltern, driven onwards by a hypocritical, ruthless, and decadent ruling class that makes its own rules and leads society to the edge of catastrophe, for the imperial subaltern, there are no fixed rules of the game. There are no necessary truths. There's only the fascination of the conquest, the seduction of the game, the fluidity of strategic calculations, and the pleasure taken in the violence of sacrificial expenditure. Georges Bataille, not Foucault. All the more so with the spectacle of public deceit, which in addition to its utility in supporting specific interests, polities, and strategic tactical strategies, is directly tied to the descent of truth into the last decadent phase of nihilism. Truth today is not immune from politics. It too turns out to be a secondary effect of sacrificial violence and panic insecurity. Public lies are authorized when truth becomes an emblematic sign of sacrificial expenditure. So then, point of irony. Poststructuralism's critique of the great referential unities of agency, of self, of truth, of knowledge, of power and consciousness, Foucault leading the way, all founded on Nietzsche's understanding of the purely, what Nietzsche liked to call, perspectival character of truth, that there are no necessary truths, that there's only a perspectival truth. This great poststructuralist critique has now, definitely against the intentions of poststructuralism, been just literally seized and absorbed by the language of empire. And if when, for example, Agamben theorizes so eloquently the dark shadow of exceptionalism as the essence of contemporary politics, when he notes that it's he or she who has the power to mark the exemption, to define the norm, to demarcate the boundary, the border, the division, Agamben is, I believe, only reflecting 100 years after its original formulations, Nietzsche's intimation of the death of God and the triumph of what Nietzsche called truth as a concept fiction, a purely perspectival vision of truth, aligned today with the will to power. Now I conclude. Nihilism, I think I'll conclude with a little water. Nihilism, as the dominant historical movement of our times, is bound up with the language of cynical ideology, sometimes with perspectival truth, taking the highly invested form of panic, fear, and a religious crusade for redemptive violence, and at other times a more liquid presence in society and culture, as the law becomes not simply the norm, the sign, the exception, but something different. The lie becomes a seductive, twisting image vector, which twists, turns, and mutates, dissolves, and redissolves. The story changes, energized by pack reporting intent on seeking out the facts. A story first accepted by the many, then disbelieved by just as many, finding its final moment of contemporary closure in that supreme act of public futility, in a culture of liquid lies, the telling and retelling of the joke by all the court gestures of the nighttime talk shows, the state of terrorism on the one side, the joke on the other side. Or could it be something more excessive, that public lying today as an image vector laying siege to all the waiting subjects is not something feared by politics, and not something to be kept out of a free subjectivity, but is what truly animates contemporary politics, energizing resistance to this reordering of facts, but at the same time legitimating the possibility of truth-saying, which is held to be somehow exempt from the lie, the ontology of enlightenment. If power itself has mutated from reified object to norm to sign, and thereupon to a simulacra of images, then why not truth also? But of course, when truth becomes an image spectacle, then it must inevitably subordinate itself to the iron laws of media construction. As an image spectacle, truth is always relative, indeterminate, liquid, mutating, a surface effect with no necessary meaning or determinate end. fearless subjects all the more. So then I conclude with six preliminary theses which follow from society conceived under the sign of cynical ideology. First, no longer today power understood as power over death, but something really different today. Today it's the charismatic pull of a culture of death over a power that would seek to be normative. Secondly, not power over life, but as a perfect sign of this new age of ideology, terrorism, and religion, the promise of eternal life over a power that would always only be secular. Cynical ideology subordinates truth to the greater good of redemptive violence. This twisted tale of truth and lies becomes itself a primary instance of real violence. Thirdly, not truth in the traditional normative sense, but cynical truth. Fourth order truth for the age of the spectacle, wherein truth becomes liquid, fluid, circulating, always containing a hint of death, making of itself a moment of sacrificial expenditure motivated alternatively by the promise of transcendence and by the deep pleasures of humiliation. Fourth, while power is a relation of force, ideology is necessarily, even triumphantly, a relation of weakness. It's based on panic fear, panic insecurity. It aligns itself with fear of the outsider, the alien, the unknown, the terrorist. Masking this weakness as strength is the essence of cynical ideology. Fifth, while power produces subjectivity and enables agency, cynical ideology evacuates subjectivity and disables agency. And finally, while a gray genealogy of power stresses an ascending analysis of the mechanisms of power from the bottom to the top of hierarchies, cynical ideology is exactly the opposite. Its effects lie on the surface as a generalized psycho-ontology of redemptive violence and panicked fear, refusing to hide itself away in those bureaucratic institutions which combine to produce mechanisms of domination, the clinic, the prison, the school. Cynical ideology thrives by making a continuous spectacle of its presence. Just its Deleuze and Gotard. It's a line of flight. It's an intensity which doubles and redoubles its effects. When power becomes image, cynical truth is volatilized by the image repertoire. It knows only media effects. It migrates across different media. It changes state as it seeks points of maximal intensity for communication with a humiliated public. It is without history because it leaves no fixed electronic trail. Its truth value depends precisely on its articulation of perspectives which strengthen movements towards panic fear and redemptive violence. While power aligns itself with knowledge, not ideology, cynical ideology aligns itself with virtual truth, not power. Privileging sacrificial death over the life of power, cynical ideology represents, I believe, truth in its last decadent phase as a concept fiction. Final paragraph, I promise. In this age of cynical ideology, everything has value only to the extent that it has, as Heidegger said, abuse value. This is Heidegger. Understanding Nietzsche as the essential philosophy of completed nihilism, Heidegger drew the bitter allegorical conclusion attendant upon the reduction of being today to what he called passive standing reserve. For Heidegger, the mood of completed nihilism, the age of cynical ideology, will be what he termed the malice of strife, which takes pleasure in the greater calculus of abuse value. Today, the theater of abuse value is ubiquitous. The victims of Katrina, the civilians of Iraq found hanging on electronic hydro poles in Baghdad today, the old, the poor, the young, the sick, the powerless. Political lying is itself a form of abuse value, with the object of abuse being the rupturing of the deep connection between truth-saying, based in the singularity and the subject of subjectivity, and the responsibilities of democratic citizenship. When citizenship itself is made an object of abuse value, by manipulation of vote counts, by public deceit, by panic fear, the essential ethical core of democracy is undermined. We're left finally with the terrorism of the image, a new form of nihilism suitable for the technological age, in which ministrations of redemptive violence during the daylight hours are soothed away by the nighttime jokes of all the talk show hosts. Really, it's a moral equivalency today of nothingness, state terrorism, and the jokes of the court gesture is the basic political logic of a society of completed nihilism. This is definitely not an image of Foucault's world of normative power. Nor really in the end is it Deleuze and Guattari's searing vision of lines of flight and points of intensity, becoming wolfman, becoming maggot man, becoming predator, becoming parasite. It's about something different. It's about something new. It's still emergent. It's still articulating itself, still learning to speak, still growing in strength, still waiting to fully disclose itself. It's cynical ideology. And I'd just like to conclude with a little poem which Mary Louise and I wrote about this condition. It's called Remix Wars. It was being made into a video by Jackson Two Bears in the back and by his partner, Tanya Duty. So I should conclude with this.
Remix. Extreme makeover. Distorted images. Blurry color. Black, white, right, wrong. With us, against us. It's time to rewind. Remix. Do you get the mix? You and I have an appointment at the end of the world.
The brain is on my way, but my ears are gone streaming. I'm listening to the words of God speedy by emperor. The car is on fire, car is no driver, the car is no driver. Covers of sewers are lighted with a thousand lonely suicides. The hard, dark wind blows. You and I have an appointment at the end of the world.
You and I work.
I'm a portal to nowhere. I'm a highway to ruins. There's beer on my belly and a hot mark on my face. I'm a fire at the flush machine. I'm a highway to nowhere. I'm a portal to the ruins. The car is on fire. There's no driver at the wheel. Covers of sewers are muddy with a thousand lonely suicides. And a hard, dark wind blows. You and I have a planet at the end of the world.
Raging flesh MP3 into a black hole that is the world today. Worn symbols of nostalgia, red, white, and blue, propel airwaves, puncture light, and leave the acrid smell of disease, despair, and rancor. You and I have an appointment at the end of the world. The doll-like figure wrapped in tissue has an eye where her stomach should be. Her lips move, but it's her eye that speaks. You and I have an appointment at the end of the world.
Tribes of the Mad Dog Night. Children of the electronic sky. Howling at the speed of torture. The reality shows on the air. And it's showing those bodies of pleasure, bodies of pain. Smeared feelings, streamed eyes,
or eye,
draft of fat. And over there in the corner, there's some low-belly talking going on. Stories of the maggot man and the rat-faced man, and the blonde beasts of prey, meeting up in their Nietzsche, tribes of the mad-dog night, getting ready. For you and I have an appointment at the end of the world.
Thanks very much.